All right, welcome to Free Radical Radio. This is episode 82. Today we are graced with the presence of a noted anarchist thinker, a host of three radio shows, none of them equaling the 2 to 2.5 hour marathon that is often Free Radical Radio, a show called Inconsiderate Audio, a dandy of the first degree, I believe. Squee, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Terrific.
All right, not only do we have Squee here, we are graced with the presence once again of RevDoc to the left of me.
Hey.
There he is. Hanging out, doing the show. Bellamy is somewhere up in the Northwest. There may not be some rumors that he's only allowed in certain countries. We'll figure that out later. But either way, he's definitely not here. So, what's been going on lately, Squee?
You know, besides getting punched in the face for no reason. having a good time, enjoying Berkeley. Still getting used to it.
This is true. I did bring Squee out with me the other night to a, what is it, Dark Wave? Is that the new music that we like here?
Oh, I don't know. They called itself that, but... Yeah. Could have been something totally different.
If anyone knows what dark wave means, feel free to email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net because it means something, but I don't know what.
Well, yeah, there's a band called Dark Wave, but it's also a genre for dark waves.
Well, either way, we're definitely outside, possibly having a cigarette, possibly indulging in an adult beverage when someone I was meeting there ended up deciding that they were going to live free of desire or live free with their desires. They were not going to be held back by the mores of society, typical things like not, you know, attacking the humans next to you for no reason. It didn't enter their mind, and they gave one Squee a fist right to the face there.
I was very confused.
Yes, we were all confused by her actions.
Yeah. It ended well. It was a good night.
It was a good night. Everyone had fun. It was that was a thing that happened. All right, so today's show is going to be a little bit different. We're going to do fireside chats. You might have caught our last fireside chat where I talked about Musil, Robert Musil, and Hermann Brock, and some other Eastern European writers that I'm fond of. Today, our fireside chat is going to be of John Gray, who is, I guess you could call him a philosopher, modern philosopher?
Sort of,
something like that. Either way, he wrote a book called Straw Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals. And of course, I didn't prepare the quote on a straw dog, but it's a Lao Tzu quote. The book's a reference to the idea of creating these straw dogs, which you kind of imbue with, some type of meaning. And then as soon as you're done with whatever ritual or ceremony, you treat them as straw dogs and you set them on fire, you smash them, et cetera, et cetera. So, all right. So one of the things that John Gray talks about in this book is science, which seems to come up more with nihilist people than other people, the problem of science. I guess some anti-civ people talk about it. It gets used a lot, anthropology, biology, all the other ologies, to kind of ground, like, that has air quotes around it, to ground people's, like, radical praxis. And, you know, some people take issue with that. And one of the people that takes issue with that is John Gray. And before he starts his book, he quotes, how do you say that, Jacques Monod? How do you say his
name? I have no idea.
All right,
I've only read it.
He quotes this guy, Jacques Monod, who wrote that, quote, "All religions, nearly all philosophies, and even a part of science testify to the unwearing, heroic effort of mankind desperately denying its contingency." So to me, this means that mankind and the individual human often expend a lot of energy disconnecting themselves from the world, pretending they can exist in a cloud of thought, and that somehow are saved from the real. And I would say what John Gray considers to be the real, which is something we're going to get into here in a second, is that all you kind of exist in is this momentary assembly of the things around you. And let's kind of get down to what he's really talking about there. So he makes a lot of arguments about the Christian roots of science. And one of John Gray, he starts the book talking about how society misunderstands Darwin. And Gray believes that Darwin taught us, quote, that species are only assemblies of their genes, interacting at random with each other in their shifting environment. Yet it is forgotten when people talk of the progress of mankind. They have put their faith in an abstraction that no one would think of taking seriously if we're not formed from cast-off Christian hopes. Darwin showed that humans are like other animals. Humanists claim that they are not. So Gray continues to attack humanism here for believing in progress, and he continues on to write that to believe in progress is to believe that by using the new powers given to us by scientific knowledge, humans can free themselves from the limits that frame the lives of other animals. So here, humanists and progress-driven moralists are saying that they believe that because somehow our knowledge is increasing, and so it's almost like a formula, so our knowledge is increasing over the years, we have more scientific understanding, and we are learning lessons on how to live that will help us achieve peace, prosperity, and happiness. And that's, to me, that's pretty easily negatable. I think one of the things we can do is look at pessimistic induction, realize that all we realize is, or over time, every idea we realize is wrong. Almost nothing stays, even for a little bit, and let alone for a long bit. And we negate progress pretty often on the show in our section Notes on Progress. And, you know, we recently did that with that study on race, where they did this, like, really decade-long big study on race between generations, and it showed that, or excuse me, racism between generations, which showed that millennials, which is basically the generation that's young-ish now, have the same, racism is the same across all the generational stratuses or whatever.
Right, yeah, basically it just has a different form.
Yeah, totally. So, which I think is, it almost becomes, it's hard for me not to take a regressivist view here and say things are getting worse as things take on different qualities and different forms. And, you know, they take on the form of, you know, the mass industrial complex prison-y thing, and animal agriculture has taken on this, like, massive thing across the world, and regular agriculture. So it's hard to, when people tell me that's progress, it's hard to really believe that lie, but I guess that's one way to keep getting up and going to work every day. I mean, that and coffee and pizza.
Especially coffee.
Yeah, especially pizza. Rev Doc wants more pizza right now. There they go. Okay, so what Gray does then is he moves towards the final aims of the humanist and the progress-driven person, which he says are to use technology to surge forward the destiny of humanity towards peace. So when he continues on, this is what he says about that. He says, "Nothing is more commonplace than to lament the moral progress that has failed to keep pace with scientific knowledge. If we were only more intelligent or moral, we could use technology for benign ends. The fault is not in our tools, we say, but in ourselves. In one sense, this is true. Technological progress leaves only one problem unsolved, the frailty of human nature. Unfortunately, this problem is insoluble." So, I mean, he's basically just talking about how technology has affected our lives throughout the future, or throughout the past, and how it affects our lives now and will continue to affect them. And so what he does before that is he makes this argument that he actually, it's kind of funny because he uses a little bit of anthropology here, which kind of seems silly in the way that he's critiquing all these things. But either way, he talks about how humans sometimes would move to like a certain island and they would hunt all the fish in one area or all the deer off like an island, or and that the only thing that would contain them is the way their populations were. And he talks about the idea or the theory that humans will self-regulate in small communities, that they'll do like infanticide or won't have as many children or will stop having sex as much or will do many different kinds of things to limit their population in certain situations when food is scarce. And, you know, there's also the problem of predators, which we don't really have anymore now that we're like the ultimate apex predator, which I was asking Bellamy the other day, how can anyone be depressed when they're an apex predator? I'm still confused about that.
Well, there's sad monsters everywhere.
I guess that's true. I guess most monsters seem to be a little sad, huh?
Yeah.
I guess that's so we can pity them and not have to see the monster within us. No response from Squee there. Okay. So he keeps making these arguments, and I kind of feel like this, the best place the book leads for me, besides he it's not so much that it's anti-technology, although I think it definitely has those undertones and is easy to use his arguments to make an anti-technology argument. But to me, what's a little bit more interesting is the way that he talks about identity. So he makes a lot of big arguments in the book about consciousness being a myth and talking about how we fetishize choice. And he goes off about how the most important parts of our lives we don't choose. So he's saying we don't choose how we look, how people perceive us. We don't choose our first language, the country we were born in, the body we were given. And then he goes on to talk, he brings up Freud, which makes sense, and he talks about how much of our life exists in dreams upon which we have little to no understanding. And then he goes off and talks about a neuroscientist who at some point concluded that all of our decisions are made within 0.5 seconds of the time we actually make the decision. And it's funny, I was bringing this up to Bellamy the other day, and they were telling me that they think the hard work that they go into thinking about problems leading up to the problem affects that 0.5 second decision, which is a pretty reasonable counterargument.
Yeah, well, are these the studies that conclude decisions are shown to be made in the brain before you're aware they're made?
Okay. Totally.
Yeah, I think if there's any kind of potential for an intentional choice, it has to be made for the future, long before the moment comes.
Yeah, totally. Because I think it makes sense that in the moment, you know, you only have a set amount of time and ways to process these things. It almost seems like an unconscious thing. I remember when I broke up with my ex, actually, I've been waiting to have this conversation for a really long time. It's like a year ago. And I'd been basically wanting to break up with him for a long time, but I couldn't, and it didn't happen. And then all of a sudden, like, something just happened where in the moment they started finally having this conversation I've been wanting to have about this thing. And it was just, boom, like a lightning strike. It's almost like the way Sharon writes about suicide, and the only good suicide is the lightning strike suicide. It was like the lightning strike murder of this relationship.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's always, you know, a lot of other things besides vocalizing or verbal language that are going into why a conversation will happen or what kind of cues you're picking up from each other. And I think a lot of these things express themselves long before.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to take this. And since I'm mostly an active person and I'm happy to discuss and think about things that I never know, but I kind of feel like even though I think it's reasonable to say, like, oh, maybe this isn't real, maybe consciousness isn't real, maybe choice is just a fetish, but I think it only really makes sense to live your life as if you have choice and to actively keep trying to choose things, because I don't really see a way to live the other way. I guess maybe passive nihilism would be a way to do that.
I don't know if there's really a way. I mean, that's Albert Camus' whole point of the absurd, is basically, even though life has no inherent meaning, we're condemned to pretend it does, or to try to bring meaning out of it, which includes, you know, choice.
Yeah. So I think a more interesting place to take that would be to move towards identity eliminativism. And so I can say that since I was given these identities, I didn't choose any of them, I can say fuck them, and accept, you know, as Darwin said, that I'm just this assembly of myself and the things around me. And I don't want to get too deep into this, but obviously the annoying part of this is that people are going to bring up anti-oppression and privilege stuff when you get into identity stuff. But I don't really want to get into that whole rigmarole. We've talked about that extensively on the show. Instead, I want to just ask, once again, can we accept fluidity? And that, can we accept that we are creatures of desires, many of which, even though I want to try to understand them, we will never be able to fully understand, no matter how hard we try. And that's just understanding ourselves, let alone the idea of understanding another person, another assembly, and what that means. And I want to bring up a Delaney quote. I recently read Sam Delaney's Hog, which was a book he couldn't get published for like 25 years, because the book is hardcore pornography throughout a lot of it. So if you're not interested in people eating shit, it's probably not the book for you.
I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
But I am interested in people eating shit.
Yeah. And it's beyond that. It's kind of interesting that he didn't get thrown in to the whole Hakim Bey with any kind of that kind of drama of pedophilia, because the book is written by an 11-year-old boy named Cocksucker who joins this group of people doing some shit that, you know, I'd have to give out the old trigger warning for if I want to keep talking about it, which has, I think, did you recently talk about an article about that?
I wrote something about it. It was, you know, just a response, but generally I don't like anything like a trigger warning, whether it's not safe for work or parental advisory. I think there's a whole point to be made about this sort of liberal mindset where you want to protect other people from getting harmed, and then you go out and you take responsibility away from them.
Yeah, and I think one of the funnier things, I don't know if I've talked to you about this yet, is if you've like watched the Stimulator Submedia show recently, he does trigger warnings now, and the trigger warning is like pops up on the screen as this like giant pulsating heart, and it's like ba boom, ba boom. It's just like these loud noises of the heart beating, and I'm like, oh my god, like his trigger warning is triggering me right now.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening. Although, you know, I mean,
it's the price you got to pay to get your riot porn.
There's actually a huge thing to talk about here when it comes to trigger warnings and choice. If you want to tie those two things together. It's definitely an anti sort of choice perspective to have trigger warnings around everywhere.
Like, yeah, totally. That's, you know, I mean, I think that also comes into the idea of like safe spaces and like what that actually means.
Sure, definitely. I mean, it's basically the same idea, to create a zone where people could have a perfect little ideal world.
Would you call it a temporary autonomous zone?
No.
Me neither. All right, so let's that was a good tangent, but we're going to break back into Hog here. This is a quote from Sam Delaney in that book, and it's a quote from the main character whose name is Hog when someone's trying to tell him that he's normal, not that Hog is normal, but that the other character is normal, and Hog has something to say about what normal means. He says, I think I ain't never met a normal, I mean normal, man who wasn't crazy. Loon crazy. Take him off and put him away crazy. Which is what they would do if there wasn't so many of them. Every normal man, I mean sexually normal now, man I ever met figures the whole thing runs between two points. What he wants and what he thinks should be. Every thought in his head is directed to fixing a rule straight line between them. And he calls that line what is, on the other hand, every faggot or panty sucker or whip jockey or SM freak or baby fucker or even a motherfucker like me, we know. And his hands come down like he was pushing something away. We know, man, that there is what we want, there is what should be, and there is what is. And don't none of them got anything to do with each other. And it's a little bit hard to explain without the book, but I think what he's basically talking about here is desires and what they mean, and obviously the idea of how ridiculous it is to be normal, or that even choosing our desires is something I think, I don't know, I have ambivalent feelings on, but either way, he's kind of getting into what John Gray is saying too about there being no set nature for a person and only the individual human and what they are, and kind of negating an idea of humanity and like the progress of humanity is more just a sequence of individuals acting throughout time, which is real or not real.
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely think there needs to be something denied about the notion of human nature. It's a very old kind of naive belief, but I don't know if I would take it to the point of saying that social life or history or what we know as society is individuals and their kind of cut-off desires playing out.
Yeah, I guess that the problem with that would be the idea of, like, domination and stuff across and having so many people who are, like, willing to follow or, like, drop in line to authority or be slaved or enslaved.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's apathy is a great force in history, yeah. As some fucking idiot American said once, I'm sure.
Some idiot said that. All right, so I kind of wanted to conclude the John Gray section with some thoughts on activism and some thoughts on the left and what John Gray seems to be calling death fighters. And he's kind of talking about people who are trying to change the world in a controlling way, not someone like a Novatory who is just trying to free themselves or to free up space for their own desires, but someone who's trying to create more of like a controlled situation as most leftists and anarcho-liberals would tend to do. So this is what he has to say. He says, those who struggle to change the world see themselves as noble, even tragic figures. Yet most of those who work for world betterment are not rebels against the scheme of things. They seek consolation for a truth they are too weak to bear. At the bottom, their faith that the world can be transformed by human will is a denial of their own mortality.
Love it.
Yeah. So this is obviously the extreme, and that's why I've been kind of trying to get into with this John Gray stuff, is that, you know, clearly to say we have no consciousness, we can't make choice, these are all definitely extremes, but I don't know if we can't explore the extreme and at least try to wear it for a second and see what it feels like, how can we really challenge our ideas? And this just gets back to my main issue with, you know, anarchist scenes and places in general and like safer spaces, is how can we really challenge ourselves and each other if we're not willing to, you know, go to the extremes of thought and see what else is out there and see where we fit in that whole thing.
I think there's something important about mortality there too, though. It really guides a lot of these, not only identity, but this whole idea that you could improve the world and create this situation that's going to, I don't know, fucking magically make things okay for you. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think once you get rid of the bad things in life, then you're screwing yourself, ultimately.
Yeah, and I do think it does relate a lot to more, like, just the idea of control is trying to negate the chaos that exists in order for order, because if you can order and control things, then you can set, like, a time frame on them, and maybe they don't have to end, maybe you don't have to die.
Yeah, and you do.
But you do.
You have to die.
And we're going to conclude that section with Robinson Jefferson. Ugh, that's a sentence right there. When speaking of saviors and crowds, Robinson Jefferson once wrote that, in the disastrous rhythm, the heavy and mobile masses, the dance of the dream-led masses down the dark mountain. So, that's a little Robinson Jeffers. How much time do we have left, Rev Dot?
We've got 6 minutes.
Okay. This is Free Radical Radio. I'm sitting here with Squee in the studio. Today on the show, we are going to do much later, we're going to do a debate between two competing ideologies, if you can call them that, necro-anarcho and post-nihilism. We're going to talk about the farmer neighborhood in Tempe, Arizona?
Yeah, Tempe, Phoenix in general, too, because it relates to that context.
We're going to talk about wild reaction, as we often do on the show, and maybe we'll have some other surprises. All right, this is Free Radical Radio. You can find us at freeradicalradio.net. You can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net, and we'll be back.
If you need an ear to talk to, I've got a bushel of corn that's brand new. Catching dolphins and narwhals and hairnets, keeping wood nymphs and griffins as house pets, setting fire to the things I spend my cash on, using my laptop to at least get a hard on. I can escape my imagination. I can escape this swirling hellish maelstrom. If you're looking for a place to plant your tulips, don't forget that I'm just right around the corner. If you need an ear to talk to, I've got a bushel of corn that's brand new. Catching dolphins and narwhals and hairnets, keeping wood nymphs and griffins house pets, setting fire to the things I spend my cash on, using my laptop to at least get a hard on.
Once again, I just wanted to remind everyone that Bellamy is traveling up in the Pacific Northwest, so feel free to email them if you are interested in hanging out with them. And guess where we are? All right, welcome back to Free Radical Radio. That was Ivan and the Beats with Can't Escape, a classic tune of masturbation, technology, and swirling maelstroms. And we're still in the studio with Squee. All right, Squee, what's going on?
So one of the things I wanted to talk about on this show is what is happening in the neighborhood I just moved out of a few months ago. And since I've only been in the Bay Area for a few months, I really don't see a point in me making any comment on anything here.
I seem to have no issue making comments on the Bay Area.
I'm solitary and totally removed from human existence, so.
I think I might be the most social of antisocial anarchists, or at least one of them.
Yeah, maybe.
Which brings my nature into question completely.
There seems to be some social characters out and about.
This is true.
So, speaking of social anarchy and the farmer neighborhood, let me explain a little bit about what that is. Phoenix is generally a conservative, corrupt, fucked up, and boring place. This is well known. Nobody wants to go there unless they have ulterior motives. And one of those motives might be to come to my old neighborhood. Because Phoenix is so boring, there's basically two, maybe three places that people are going to move if they want to have a good time and actually live somewhere where they're going to get along with people. One of those is the Arts District, and there's anarchists and other radicals there that have some other things going on. One of those is Travis James. He's actually one of the world's greatest nihilists.
Doesn't
get enough credit. He did the Inconsiderate Audio podcast that I was partially given credit for earlier.
Some people say Free Radical Radio destroyed that project in its proto-existence.
Yeah, no, it was the consequence of determined nature.
I see.
So anyway, so Phoenix has its own thing going on, but then there's Tempe. And Tempe has its own history that goes back probably about 15 years to when Phoenix Anarchist Coalition started meeting at this cooperative grocery store that used to exist in the Tempe area. Eventually that closed down, and it was the closing of what was called the Gentle Strength Co-op, a name that I fully support, was sort of a prelude to what would eventually happen generally in Tempe, which is a redevelopment project by the state to put in a bunch of really bougie, ritzy condos and apartment complexes for rich college kids to live in. And along with the redevelopment, maybe gentrification, although I don't know. I guess that term works. The police are given the task of making it a safe space so that the yuppies can feel good walking around and shopping and eating at their crappy bougie restaurants. Right. So one of the things the police will do is at the beginning of every school year, because this is a college town and ASU is right next to this neighborhood, is they will bring in about 12 to last year, I think it was 19 separate police departments to lock the city down. And actually, if you look at the numbers and do a comparison to the New York's, what was it fucking called?
What in New York?
Where they're padding, Stop and Frisk.
Oh, Stop and Frisk, yeah.
Yeah, the numbers actually rival Stop and Frisk if you take the amount of police compared to the amount of population during the times when the shutdown was happening. They're really high up there. I think it was something like 40,000 people in 3 weekends that were stopped and not cited for anything. And the police, like, they won't release any information on how it breaks down ethnically or anything like that.
Okay.
But as a response to stuff like this, a lot of the locals have gotten really pissed off about how they're being treated by the state. And this is also a population that is generally into having a good time and partying and drinking and doing whatever the fuck they want. So to have 19 police departments come in and start stopping you when you're walking from your third bar to the fourth bar that you want to go to is not a good thing.
So safe to say these people might not love the police so much after this?
No. Explicitly do not love the police. And this sort of... So all of these things together kind of shape what's going on, but they don't shape what anarchists have been doing in the neighborhood. So the way that this is working out is mostly over Facebook, anarchists started a neighborhood group. And while that sounds like it might not be very important, it's turned out to be a big deal. There's something like 2,000 to 3,000 people that are part of this group now. And they're
Which you can contrast with East Bay Solidarity Network, which has existed for like a few years now and is technically a neighborhood group and has almost no one in it. I feel like their mailing list is probably... I mean, it's definitely well under 1,000, like probably closer to a couple hundred at most.
Yeah, and so this brings up an important point, and it's that this is not an activist project. It is not ideological, and it's explicitly anarchist when anarchists are talking about it, but the participation is all over the place. It's really a local phenomenon. So the Facebook thing is interesting. One reason it's interesting is because Facebook is critiqued heavily and people are wary of using it for organizing or doing any kind of anything important. However, it has actually facilitated a more rebellious atmosphere and some real stuff has come out of it.
So what would you say is like the manifestation of the... of the way the neighborhood's like kind of ethos has tended at this point?
So the neighborhood's always been a bit countercultural, as I was saying. But since the police crackdown, people from the neighborhood will use this Facebook group to go and try to fuck with the city council and shut their meetings down, or to have roving parties so that the police can't actually shut them down and things like that. Something else about it is the regulations on the Facebook group are no politicians can go on there and campaign, and that's actually caused a lot of drama and it's been a big deal with the left and people like that. You know, there's the moderators are free to ban people that are fucking irritating. And that has resulted in people trying to start their own groups, which no one cares about because they're boring.
Yeah.
But most importantly, it is an everyday place where people are doing usually just neighborhood stuff, kind of creating their own mythology about themselves and creating a sort of culture that is unique and has its own jargon, its own jokes, its own philosophy about how to live life.
Yeah, that's interesting to contrast with so much of the other anarchist shit that is just boring. And I mean, we ask this all the time, but what's even the point of anarchy and anarchist project if it's boring? Life is already boring.
And I think that's the conclusion that myself and other people that have participated in this have reached, is that the unifying principle, at least in this neighborhood, should be to party and have a good time. And the people that know how to party the least happen to be authoritarians. They are bad partiers, that and frat boys. But that's a different thing.
Yeah.
They don't know how to party well. So this is actually the type of language that we will talk about these situations in, is, does it make it more fun? Are people able to have a good time? And the ethics, or however you want to put it, that result from this is very anti-authoritarian. And it turns out that nobody wants to deal with politics. No one wants to deal with police. People hate their landlord. People want to fuck in public. People want to open carry alcohol.
Yeah.
There's really no upper limit on the freedom to sort of thing that people want to do, except don't be a dick, bro.
Yeah. So do you feel like it's kind of like a not in my backyard vibe or fuck authority feel, or do you feel like it's both? Like, I mean, I guess if you're anti-global, which is a pretty reasonable thing to be, then it doesn't matter as much if it's a NIMBY thing.
It's really hard to say. I think if you ask individual people, they'll have a wider perspective on authority elsewhere, but what's relevant is that it's your backyard, and that's sort of the whole point of the project, is to have something that's connected to where we live and not to, unlike me, just leave.
Yeah. I think it's almost like smelling like an anti-civ land defense thing. I think when a lot of people write about that, it's more, you often hear the argument about if people have a place they want to defend, if they feel a connection to something besides just the transitory nature of modernity, right, is that we can pick up and get a job in any city, and sometimes it's hard to get a job, so you get a job somewhere else on the internet or whatever, and you move, and it sounds like people might be more connected here than the average place.
They are. They're very connected, and there is a bit of a common attitude compared to something like a land defense. Although the difference is that in this neighborhood, most of the people that live there are renting. They're renting right. their houses. And usually from rich people that live in the suburban part of Tempe, or from these rental companies that are widely recognized as screwing everybody over.
Have people been doing anything against that? Or is it mostly just the roving party disruption of city council type stuff going on?
So that's actually where some of the limits are to how this is going at this point. As far as any kind of economic analysis, people have actively opposed Rentals Tempe, which is one of these rental companies. And people have some sort of sense that you shouldn't get ripped off as a consumer, but it really ends at price. And most of the things that people get irritated about is having to pay more than they think they should for something. Most people just don't want to get priced out of this neighborhood.
Right, which seems like one of the problems with anti-gentrification struggles, that they try to keep things the same. And most places, the status quo is pretty shitty.
Yeah, so you have some cooperative projects. You have, like, there's a whole big biking community, you know, bicycles out there that actually tend towards more of the liberal, let's have petitions and do things like that thing. But efforts to have some kind of collectivism or to to get rid of money or that kind of exchange between each other have been pretty minimal. And this is actually something to the credit I would give some of the other anarchists in Phoenix that I don't necessarily get along with, who are more activists, is that they see that this could kind of be looked at as a hipster project, and that it's superficial and it's not going to go any further.
Right, as opposed to, I guess, the goal of all the other projects is the old revolution that has no blood in it, just the peaceful overthrow of the government and millions of people changing the way they interact in a peaceful fashion somehow magically.
Yeah, or even an insurrection. I mean, after some of the things that have happened in Phoenix, I don't see any fucking potential for an insurrection. I mean, I have never seen the police actually get chased away from somewhere. There's no sign that they're going to get anyone's going to win anything. So a cultural approach has been the best I could see things in that area so far.
So it's a hearts and minds approach.
Well, it's more towards the genitals and the stomach.
I see. More in the guts and the desirous passions that we experience.
Definitely. Well, it really is. And it wasn't really a false category to say it's hedonistic. One of the more active people in the struggle, if you want to call it that,
yeah,
is a Jewish porn store owner.
Uh-huh.
Who considers themselves a libertine and does not give a fuck about any kind of solidarity bullshit. What they care about is fun, porn, not being a dick, and having a good time. I don't see any problem with that.
Was that Peter Kropotkin's 5 points of anarchy right there? I forget if that was him or someone else. Hard to tell.
Actually, it was Bakunin.
Oh, okay, yeah. Bakunin, a big fan of Free Radical Radio, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's who put me in touch with you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bakunin. We really appreciate everything you've done there. All right. So I guess some of the other things I'm wondering is if it's successful in your mind, why do you feel like it's such a story that's rarely told, or at least it's something that I know most people don't hear about, or do you think that's just kind of the nature of most anarchist projects?
I think there's two major reasons. I think one of the major reasons is that it's simply not seen as doing anything. People don't understand themselves, and anarchists don't understand themselves in existing in a context where just having a good time and relating to people around you is quote-unquote doing anything. There's some kind of riot porn, you know, ideology out there that's very opposed to this.
Right, you're saving someone from ennui is not the same as saving them from a landlord.
Right, which is, I think it's bullshit. I think there's a nice romantic idea about trying to create insurrections, but the ones that have been interesting haven't happened because anarchists are trying to create them. They've happened because people have lived in neighborhoods and they've lived places that they don't want to be controlled in. It's their only place to be free. And when someone tries to take that away, there's a whole psychological mechanism of loss prevention and risk avoidance where having something taken away from you is worse than just being able to get more. People are risk averse and they hate loss.
Yeah, so what do you think what do you think it means to act when you see limits to it, I guess, or when it feels like there's some type of limiting factor, such as obviously the cops or et cetera? Like if people are only resisting up to a point, where do you see still the interest in doing a project like this?
I think there's immediate benefits to doing something like this, even if there's a limit to it. I know that up until this project was happening, the general feeling of alienation or estrangement is the word I like to use instead of that in the neighborhood was a lot higher. And it's very open in the air now that people are basically against being a capitalist. They're basically against the police. You know, they want to see things set on fire. People will post like dumpsters on fire to the Facebook group and everyone will cheer kind of a thing. So you know that you're walking around in a place where this kind of behavior and liberty are expected.
Yeah.
And defended.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, especially considering what things look like here and how that seems so unrealistic here, for at least anarchists to be involved in some level because of the way most anarchists feel like they're outsiders here.
Right. Okay, so that was the other major thing. So there's the way that anarchists look at this kind of activity as being nothing, and then there's the anarchist transplant kind of situation, which, you know, can come from a couple different directions, whether it's being a traveler kid or, I guess, in the Bay Area, there's a lot of different reasons why people would be transplanted.
Well, I think a lot of people just come here because they want to be around other anarchists, basically.
Right, which, yeah, so...
Even though none of the anarchists want them here and everyone dislikes everyone and there's cool kids, actually, being here is much different than the romanticized version one might have sitting on an island in the South Pacific thinking about coming here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's cool to be around other anarchists. I'd much rather not limit myself in that way. I don't think it's very important to have an established ideology.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else you want to mention about this before we change directions?
No, I think that it's pretty good. I think I would recommend to people that are more stationary and have lived a place for 10, 15 years to try to start doing something like this. Try to get your friends to be more vocal and loud and noisy and drunk.
All right. Squee for anarcho-hedonism.
Hedonism or informal anarchism is what other people would probably call it. Fuck the organization.
You're not a big fan of organizations there?
No.
Well, there's an organization some people like, and that's what we're about to talk to right now.
Okay.
All right, so let's switch topics here, and let's just jump right fucking into the weird. And if we're going to embrace the weird, the abstract, the disillusioned, the hopeless, the sexual deviant, the sexually lonely, there's many categories on OkCupid now. You're not just restricted across the gender binary. You can queer it up. You can agender it up. You can really... all the things are possible now in the land of choice that we call America and the world, I guess. OkCupid exists everywhere, right, Squee?
Yeah, you could be sapiosexual.
Sapiosexual, that is the sexuality where you're... What is that, where someone... You like smart people?
Yep, sapiens, specifically.
So do people want to do... Before we get into the whole thing, we're going to do a whole segment on anarchists on OkCupid right now. But before we do that, do we want to just seriously question people who are sapiosexual? Because how is that different than just caring about looks? If you are given the intelligence you have or you're given the looks, what's the difference?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a moral question. I think sometimes people get, you know, they get wet or hard or whatever they do in response to smart stuff.
Okay. All right. So... I'll admit it. I've been on OkCupid. I'm not right now. I took down my profile a bit ago. Squee, do you have an active OkCupid profile?
No, I deleted mine as well.
So I guess two people that aren't on OkCupid are going to talk about it, which is not a strange thing for the show. So I'll be honest. When I started OkCupid, it was like after coming out of a bad relationship. You'll rarely hear me say I came out of a good relationship, unfortunately. Most of those have been ongoing, fluid, slow things, but go ahead.
Yeah, I've tried it a few times. I thought maybe it'd be a little different when I came to the Bay Area, but, well, I'll get into that later.
So I joined maybe like 4 years ago the first time I used it, and I was definitely not looking for sex when I first started, so it was pretty funny because I didn't really talk to anyone about it. I just kind of did it as like this secret thing. Only one of my friend B in Hawaii, was the only person I told I was doing it. That's a short for their name, not... But anyways, besides the point. So I ended up... you know, filling out the questions, blah, 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 did the whole thing. I started talking to someone, and they came over the first... They decided they wanted to come over to my house the first time. I'm like, oh, okay, that seems reasonable. And this is like 4 or 5 years ago, where I didn't realize how unreasonable it is just to have a stranger come into your like, small cave-like apartment.
That's 90s for you.
Yeah. So they came over. I sat down on the couch, and I had three couches, and they sat down right next to me. Like, our legs were touching. They put their hand down on me, and I was like, whoa, within 5 seconds, I was like, not ready for this at all. And I said, it's time for some banana bread. Do you like banana bread? I like baking banana bread. So I proceeded to start baking banana bread in the kitchen and talking to them about my love for bananas and baking. And veganism, because at the time I thought that was a reasonable thing. It's but the things that we think are reasonable change very quickly.
There's a lot going on there, wasn't there?
There was a whole lot going on. And then I ended up going in the bathroom and low-talk calling a friend of mine, my friend Angie, and saying, hey, can you call me in 15 minutes and pretend you have a car emergency? Because this is before the point in my life where I felt comfortable telling people I didn't want to have sex with them, because I felt like fucked up or wrong to tell someone I didn't want to have sex, and I had to make up some kind of lie, and I felt all this weird guilt and shame around not having sex with people who are trying to bone me. And this is jumping into therapy at the moment. I'm not paying Squee. He's eaten all the pizza that I offered him, so we're going to jump along to saying that the whole reason I joined after this whole weird experience was the idea, theoretically, was to meet people through some type of filtering process. Because for me, I'm very social. I meet people all the time. I end up going on dates fairly often, or I go through large periods where I'm meeting a lot of people. And I end up meeting people that are I don't have much in common with besides like thinking they're attractive or cute or whatever. And that usually leads to some type of disastrous situation, or not to marriage, that's for sure. But yeah, what brought things in for you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I figured I'd be in a place where I wasn't going to be meeting anyone right away. That was interesting to me. And maybe, I guess as a filter, I could try to start making my way into having a social life. It didn't work, say the least. If you try to do anything on there that's not explicitly about dating, you're fucked. Unless you're one of my friends who decided to use OkCupid as a way to advertise parties they were having. And then got banned from OkCupid for spamming everyone with party invites. That worked, but
yeah, well, I think it's weird for people to date within the anarchist scene. I mean, I didn't ask anyone out, really. That I didn't date anyone within, like, the greater, I don't want to say community because it's not a community, but whatever you want to call the scene, people who look like they're an anarchist when you look at them.
I think you're looking for trouble if you try to do that.
I think you're always looking for trouble.
yeah, but, I mean, Jesus Christ, the fucking anarchist milieu, or whatever, yeah. However you pronounce
it. Milieu. Yeah. So either way, it's like, it's kind of like window shopping for, I guess, I mean, people can lie all they want and say they're on there for, I mean, I guess some people are on there for friends, but really for a lot of people, it's about some type of, like, connection and, you know,
well, what about Tinder? Have you?
Oh God! Yeah, the right swipe machine.
Yeah.
What Tinder, the phone dating app, has some type of. Someone made an app right where it's if you left swipe, you want the you like the no which one?
Left is bad. Left is bad.
And right is good.
Right is great.
Yeah, okay. So someone, what did they do? They made an app where it just right swiped forever?
No. So the way that it seems like men have learned how to use this is they just right swipe everybody to try to offset the bias that's sort of inherent to any kind of internet dating thing. Generally what you're going to get with internet dating is female, I don't know, they get a lot more hits.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be fairly accurate. But Tinder's just for straight people, right?
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't remember defining sexuality. I think you could select who you want to see.
Oh, okay. Because there's Grindr, which is, I think, more explicit than Tinder, because I think on Grindr it actually shows you where the people are, right, if you're on there? Or at least it used to.
Well, Tinder is based on your Facebook.
Oh, okay. So it brings Facebook into the game.
It is. Yeah, it's Facebook gone nude. Or not, almost nude. Proto-nude.
Facebook gone wild. Yeah, so, I don't know. I think it's kind of this whole weird thing where you were saying, what did it eventually lead you, there was less clicks to delete it, were you saying?
Yeah, eventually I got to the point to where it was just a lot easier to delete the fucking thing than bother with it anymore.
Yeah, I feel like it kind of was this huge time thing, and then it's this thing, friend the other day was saying how, you know, it'll tell you someone's looked at your profile but they didn't like it or send you a message, so it's like, oh, hey, here's this person that actually isn't interested in you. How do you feel about that?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of disappointment with it. I also found it very difficult to get excited about anything to begin with, so I didn't have a lot of opportunity to get disappointed. But
yeah, the dating thing is weird. I guess at least there's some small level of hedonism in the bay, I guess, and if you're thinking of like kink and like sex party stuff, but it's still a scene at the end of the day.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, I'm at a point in my life to where I'm not necessarily looking for people that are similar to me. I'm a little bit bored with who I am and my own qualities. And I don't want to change, but I also, you know, I don't need to date myself anymore. Because I'm already doing that.
Yeah. Is that not going well? Looks like it's going well. You're squeeze well-dressed here.
I've glad-handed my way into a very fine life.
Yeah. If only I knew what glad-handed meant, I could respond to that.
Well, it starts with a smiley face on your hand.
Okay. I guess we're mostly also bringing it up, too, for maybe some feedback. So you can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net if you think there's something more interesting to talk about here. But I just kind of thought it was worth mentioning, since it seems like almost most anarchists I know have at least been on there for some point in time. It doesn't seem like many of them end up meeting people on there. At least for me, I don't know. Maybe people lie about how they met each other. But I don't seem to know a lot of people who've found some type of ongoing or interesting relationship through there, except for me, who I am in a situation that started there. So I'll be the outlier.
I guess my best result from it was people I already knew. And it acted as sort of a little bit of a, I don't know, a vehicle for getting it out there that we were both single and wanted to date people. But otherwise, it didn't have any kind of appeal to me as an anarchist.
Yeah, I feel like going hard with the ideology on Christian Mingle or J-Date is a far better way to go.
It's honest.
Yeah, and dating's all about honesty, if nothing else, right?
Right. Well, all of OkCupid's political questions are, they presume the state. You have an other category for one of them, and that could mean anything.
Right. There's a certain housemate here who I'm not going to say who they are, but they did once say, I love OkCupid. You just put social justice into the search finder and hundreds of people come up. And I said, that's my worst nightmare.
Yeah, I guess if you're that kind of human being, that might be right up your alley.
If you're looking for someone who is checking their privilege, who is a warrior against injustice, who's willing to step back, shut up and listen, then OkCupid is a great place to exist, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's like anything else they do on the internet.
All right, you have anything else to add to this, or is it time for music?
Let's get funky.
All right, here we go. We're getting funky. We'll be back with a debate between a post-nihilist that we have found walking the streets somewhere and a necro-anarchist who has risen from the dead.
We'll be right back. Shake, baby. Shake, baby. Shake, baby. Do you want to lay down with me? Shake, baby. Do you want to lay down by my side? Baby, do you want to lay down with me? Say, shake, baby. Do you want to lay down with me? Shake, baby. Do you want to lay down by my side? Baby, do you want to lay down with me? Say, baby. Say, baby.
All right, welcome back to Free Radical Radio. You can find us at freeradicalradio.net. You can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. Our website's undergone some changes thanks to a certain friend somewhere north of me. So thanks a lot for the website help. It's really been awesome, and we appreciate it. And once again, we have T-shirts and some other stuff. So if you are interested in that, just feel free to email us and ask us, and we'll send it to you if you, you know, hook us up with some shipping money. So anyways, just another way for us to get rich doing the show since we're all living here. Squee, you're going to have your own house soon now that you're on the show.
Yep.
All right, so we're going to do a new segment, mostly just to annoy Bellamy. And this is one where we're both going to take on a political ideology completely and argue for it as if it's all we know, think, and feel. And I'm going to take on the political ideology of post-nihilism, which was created by a genius in the Pacific Northwest last weekend. This human being is so smart, I feel like their IQ is off the charts. You know, people often say that, but this person actually broke the chart when they took an IQ test.
I'm waiting to see how this goes.
And the post-nihilist will be arguing the necro-anarchist.
Yep, the necro-anarchist is a very strange form of anarchism. It's been around for centuries, but no one really hears about it.
Right. So I'm going to inhabit the monitor and the post-nihilist. I'm going to go two ways here. Squee is going to be the necro-anarchist for debate purposes. And once again, this is a traditional debate where at the end one of us will kill the other physically.
Right.
So
two that might be a little
studio,
hard.
One leaves. So Squee doesn't know that I've brought weapons. They're unprepared, so I feel like advantage post-nihilism. So here we go. This is the post-nihilist manifesto. The post-nihilist awoke when they stared at the abyss, and the abyss blinked. In this moment, the post-nihilist understood they are everything and nothing. They are the poles of binary that negate the binary. They are the creation and destruction that annihilate meaning, reason, and existence. The post-nihilist is the blinking abyss. The post-nihilist has a privileged access to the real, and because of this, they know there is no real. The post-nihilist carries the burden of this knowledge and of the fact that this knowledge was never learned. It was always with them, and never existed. The post-nihilist is a modern anarchist. The post-nihilist eschews the idea of history and claims modernity as their own, as all there is, past, present, future. It is all ours. In taking everything, we are nothing. Nothing but an assemblage of the moment, which of course does not exist. The post-nihilist does not exist. The post-nihilist is but a dream. Passing hallucination, the light you see when you close your eyes, the sound you hear in an empty room, the visage of eternity and non-existence. All right, Squee, you want to give the old that was the post-nihilist manifesto. Are you ready for the necro-anarchist?
Yeah, I'm gonna. All right, so this is necro-anarchist grimoire, and I don't know who wrote it, but it's apparently it's very deep and very goth. Life is a short blip of resistance to the entropic expansion of energy that has been ongoing since the beginning of the universe. At its most celebrated center of expression, humans, it is still merely an organized battery excreting through its leaks ever more diminished forms of energy. Energy, that beautiful and chaotic phenomenon that warms the cold, moves the stationary, and navigates this disgusting world of material objects. Energy subjects everything to its needs. If a sewage system guides it in one moment, it speeds out from an explosive in a toilet the next. Energy refuses order. Living is a practice of conservation, a fearful, embarrassing, and futile attempt by order to get that, to get what it can from its principles of prudence. There is nothing at all worth celebrating about the living. Human life has always organized itself to consume as much as it possibly can. All the better for correcting the terrible accident that is life on planet Earth. The Earth is a greedy and obnoxious planet. budding everywhere with hungry life forms stubbornly standing in the way of the goals of the universe. That goal, like all goals, is death. Human sentimentality about death has only helped death reign greater. The more that humans produce, the more that they consume, the more that dies, the more that the total energy trapped by the Earth can escape to its true path of expansion. Human sentimentality cannot hide the fact that death is really the only human goal. Life is order's cruel device to move energy around. Human life, its most pitiful form, because for as much as sentimentality may fear death, the deeper fear is to never die. Thanatos. Thanatos is most explicit when humans burn up all the chemicals that hide from consciousness how painful and terrifying organic processes truly are. The best cure for sentimentality? A quick purge of endorphins from the organism. A sharp revelation about what human life is and how much illusion must be maintained to keep on going. Nevertheless, Thanatos is shoved back into its expression through mythic beings, ghosts, ancestral spirits, vampires, and heavens. The lust for death is left to sneak around and hide amongst the psyche's shadows, but death wins and chaos smiles. Death and darkness wins in the end, despite any half-wit's attempt to concoct a greater life-affirming force in the universe. Let no one doubt that the state is an expression of humanity's most despicable and dishonest urge to order, an urge that evaluates everything according to the gold standard of life affirmation. Make no mistake, the state would go to any extent to ensure that humanity can continue to continue the project of growing its populations, even if those populations are complete automatons. The state refuses death, and the death of its citizens will always be a practical calculation, a reluctant necessity. It will never admit to the ridiculous aims of its urge to order. Life. Human life. And as much of it as can promote the existence of. Necro-anarchists do not take death for granted. The authoritarian says, "Live! We must live! Be strong and live!" We say, "I will kill you." Some anarchists want to be nice little leaders of a new order, these saints of anarchy, these imbeciles. They give in to their sentimentality and they will always be little students of statehood. Necro-anarchists know better, that death is the only thing worth talking about. And not just the fact of the matter, as outlined above, but how to exist in this tortured position as a form of life. How to act in affinity with death, with Thanatos, with energy and chaos. There isn't any need to elaborate on an anarchist position from the necro-conviction forward. It would appear to an idiot as the same formal checklist of goods and bads as any other anarchism. To a smarter idiot, the consequences of a necro-conviction should be obvious enough. We necros are the dark lords of the urge to chaos. Now you have our name.
All right, thank you, necro-anarchist, for that. And we're going to ask a series of questions and have the post-nihilist and necro-anarchist answer them. If they want, they are allowed to engage with each other after the person's answer. They don't have to. That's up to them. And at the end, we will choose a winner. So let's get into part one, the history section. So, Squee, how did we get into this situation?
Alien astronauts, but that's not important. What is important is to recognize that matter itself is an expression of the compulsion to order, and at a sufficient degree of complexity, this order seems to humans as something more important. Life. For a while, humans accepted the relief of and justice of death, but they've grown weak and hopeful, stupidly.
The post-nihilist would say, there is no growing. There's no growing stronger. There's no growing weaker. As for history, we are this situation. We are history. We are the moment. There is no here from there. There is no there from here. Death and life are but illusions. And as they say in the Iron Islands of Game of Thrones, what is dead may never die. All right. Let's hit another question. What is a human?
A human is a bad act. I'm trying to boo off the stage of history.
The post-nihilist believes there is no such thing as a human. We are but an assembly of the things around us and ourselves. In fact, there is no us. There is no humanity. There are only more momentary assemblies. All right. What is our responsibility to each other?
We are responsible to help each other overcome the compulsion to order, to life, to banish the cursed fear of death from one another's wayward thoughts.
That's assuming we have thoughts. The post-nihilist believes that since we are not conscious and have no choice, we have only the responsibility to accept this, which we'll either do or not do, and which doing or not doing we have no control over either way. We cannot overcome order. We are already agents of chaos, whether we like it or not. All right, part two. How does anarchy play into your political philosophy?
I think its proponents have done a marvelous job of destroying the compulsion to order. Some have succeeded.
Since we don't believe in human nature here at post-nihilist land, we don't believe in any kind of human nature or to destroy or any type of convulsions. All we are is a series of desires that come from our subconscious that we don't understand. And because of this, we despise the anarchist who maintains and upholds structures of order, who believes in progress, who moralizes.
Ha! Huh.
We cherish the anarchists who understand that without meaning, we are free to exist moment to moment from our arbitrary desires. All right. Mr. Necro-Anarchist, which anarchist do you most admire?
Skeletor.
The post-nihilist only admires themselves, as they are anarchy in each moment, which doesn't exist. Which anarchist do you despise the most?
Kropotkin, of course. Peter.
Since the post-nihilist is reasonable, they despise Chris Crass, because everyone and every assemblage hates Chris Crass. And the entire universe is one assemblage of hate and ill will towards this awful human.
Chris Crass sucks.
That might be the only place we agree. Which tendencies inspired your philosophy?
Most of my inspiration comes from the Spanish anarchists who were involved with Art Nouveau, mostly because they're dead. Also, because nature.
All right. The post-nihilist has no philosophy. If we were to be inspired, we could not comprehend what it was that inspired us, and we will continue to act without consciousness, as we always do. Part three, what is your take on identity politics?
It's not the sort of death I'm interested in. I identify with the principle of energy, which can mean anything. Identity in the politics sense is nowhere near as old and smelly as it needs to be.
That's interesting you believe in smell. I'm not sure the post-nihilist would agree with that. I don't know if the post-nihilist thinks we have senses. It would seem not. And the post-nihilist strongly identifies as constantly fluid assemblages of all that surrounds them, and that which we cannot see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or understand. All right. What is the necro-anarchist's relationship to the left?
I'm okay with Satanists, Luciferians, and other left-hand path orientations, but I prefer chaos.
It's interesting you prefer chaos over there when you seem to be compelled to order.
There is no order.
It seems like your chaos is less chaotic than one might hope for out of a pure chaos. Not imbued with the morality of progress towards death.
Chaos is something that can only temporarily ever be identified with. Once we die, then we get there. Until then, you know, yay Satan.
I think the audience will understand what's going on there. The post-nihilist relationship to the left is that they are actually part of our assemblage. The left is me. No matter what my desires are, I am them. We are them. And accepting that we are nothing, they too are nullified.
So you're saying you support Crowley?
I neither support or negate anything.
And Anton LaVey?
No feelings. The post-necro-anarchist, that's a new one. The post-nihilist has moved beyond feelings.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. All right, what's your take on activism, necro-anarchist?
It depends on the activity. The surrealists were interesting. I'm disappointed with the pro-Kevorkian activists. They didn't go far enough.
The post-nihilist has nothing to say. We cannot choose. So acting and activism are the most irrelevant things possible for anyone who considers himself to be an assemblage or even a human being. Squee, what do you cook at Food Not Bombs as a necro-anarchist?
Everything. Rats, bugs, tofu, tables. Burning things is one of the few ways that you could untangle this whole mess that is the life situation.
What would you say to those that say when the forest burns, it refills with life shortly thereafter?
That's just the earth trying to capture more energy, and when you burn it, that's more energy that could be released through the atmosphere and out to the rest of the universe where it gets trapped somewhere else. But that's okay, it'll all end and everything will die.
Sounds like the necro-anarchist has a strong urge to the scientific progress.
It's not science, it's project. Progress.
All right.
It's actually just death doing its thing and, you know, life pretending that it could do something about it.
The post-nihilists, much like in Peter Pan, they imagine their food and they eat and share the imagined food. They actually don't need to consume things because they are everything. There's no difference between a food item and the human item. They are all simply assemblages of cells and molecules floating freely through the universe that obviously does not exist.
Of course the post-nihilist has no taste.
Only those who exist completely in a world of their own unthought desires can eat with the post-nihilist. Which does not include the necro-anarchist. All right, what is your biggest problem with post-nihilism?
It's too bright and optimistic. Confetti-like. Post-nihilists are good at making things explode, but their let-it-be hippie attitude about the bits is cringeworthy. Even the bits must go.
The post-nihilists can't really argue with that. They have a strong belief that the universe is conspiring against us. So it's very difficult not to believe that. So the post-nihilist takes issue, strong issue, very, very strong issue, of any type of binary of life and death, any binary, any existence. There's nothing we don't take issue with and nothing we aren't accepting of. We take issue and we accept the idea that there is any progress, even toward a death, which we don't believe in.
Yes, necro-anarcho only works on the level of two dimensions. It's completely based on a binary system.
Yes, this is the main problem with necro-anarcho.
It's its main feature.
What do you like most about post-nihilism?
Post-nihilists are good at avoiding the life trap, but they haven't discovered their purpose, which is to die. Their uselessness is an improvement on anything else, which is almost like being dead.
Almost like being dead. The post-nihilist appreciates the necro-anarchist's attempt to eschew the idea of life, but in doing this, they have found the opposite, death. The resentment game is strong in the necro-anarchist. They accept the binary and progress toward one pole of it. Good try, necro-anarchist, but no good.
We're still going to win.
All right, so that's up to you. Listen, if you're still out there listening, you're a special human being. All right, this has been a strange edition of Free Radical Radio. You can find us on freeradicalradio.net. You can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. And hopefully we'll be back to doing shows. We should be back to doing shows every week. I have some interviews planned. Not going to give anything away, but I'll post about it online when they're confirmed. Thanks, Squee, for coming in. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
The necro-anarchist is very polite always. All right. Thanks for listening.